we have a very, very special guest. Know him well. He did a tremendous job in Bloomfield and Fairfield, and he is our special guest, David Tytle, former superintendent in both those areas.
That's right, David, now a professor at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. He's in our Touchpoints Rehab interview chair, and he's going to take phone calls. If you have any questions about education, let her rip at 888-574-2723. David, good morning, and thanks for making the trip up to Connecticut
good
here
morning,
in Bloomfield from Fairfield.
No, it's great. Great to be here. It's like old times. Love coming back to Bloomfield. I had a great eight-year run here, and always had great support from you, Brad, and Dan, so great to be here.
Yeah. And you were a superintendent in Fairfield for how long?
6 years in Fairfield. Did about 8.5 years in Bloomfield, so 14.5 years as a superintendent. I did 12 years as an assistant superintendent in Waterford, southeastern Connecticut, so I've covered the state from southeast to southwest and central, and retired in July of 2016, and now I'm a professor of educational administration at Sacred Heart.
Sacred Heart is a tremendous.
It's a great
You've
university.
Been there, Dan.
Yes, I have. A couple of times. A great university. David, what are some of the differences serving as a school superintendent in Greater Hartford and then in Fairfield County?
You know, it's almost like we have two or three different states in Connecticut. Southwestern Connecticut, Fairfield County is just a completely different animal. There is much more of a New York orientation in southwestern Connecticut. In fact, quite a bit of what happens up in Hartford, until it really sort of touches you personally down there, often goes unnoticed. There's not a whole lot of media coverage down there. And it's very different. But it is also, depending on what town you're in, there could be a lot of similarities. And if you're in a well-to-do suburb in Greater Hartford, it's probably very similar to being in a Fairfield or Weston or Westport there. I'm sure, you know, Avon and Simsbury have very similar challenges to what we had in Fairfield. Of course, down there, they expect you to be, you know, number one in everything. Number two isn't good enough. Number right. one in everything.
But you know something? I'll tell you, here, you got to be proud of Bloomfield. Bloomfield ratings right up there now, and you started all this, David, and you always were the kind of guy that said, by God, I hope somebody can do a little bit better than I did. But it's just grown and grown and grown.
Yeah, no, it was a great 8-plus year run there. I was really proud of what we were able to accomplish. But I always felt that, you know, at some point, somebody has to step in, take the reins, and then take it to another level. Plus, there's only so much a single human being can do when you run a school system. There are no really hero superintendents out there. It's got to be done with a full team of people, and attracting and keeping and nurturing that team is critical. So I was so happy to see all the great success that Bloomfield's had after I left, because you just build on what happened before. And let's face it, there's some people that don't see things that way. You know, when they leave a job, they're sort of secretly hoping it falls apart so they'll look better. You know? And I didn't feel that way when I left Bloomfield, and I don't feel that way when I left Fairfield. I'm always rooting for my successor to do even better.
You might have retired at the right time, because what is the school superintendent going through right now because of the state budget crisis, and in fact, the state operating on an emergency budget?
Yeah, it's awful. I don't think there was ever a year in doing budgets where anybody felt like, we have all the money we want. Just tell us what you want for a budget. You can have it. There's always been a budget crunch. There's always been it's always been a bad year to give you money in your budget. Every superintendent hears that every year. But this is the first year where there's actual uncertainty as you start the year as to whether or not you can actually spend your budget, because you don't know, for example, from the state, are we going to get our ECS money, education cost sharing money? For some school districts, that's a big chunk of change. They can't just absorb that into the bloodstream. The other thing is that there's a lot of uncertainty around special education funding. That's a huge cost in school districts, that the state has traditionally picked up some of that. And so what you're doing now as a superintendent is you're going in with maybe an approved budget, but you're not sure you can actually spend it. And the longer it goes, the worse it gets. And then that's on the operating budget side. On the other side is because of the state's difficulties, there's a lot of uncertainty about the state's funding of building projects, current building projects or projects that have just been submitted. And so towns might be thinking, we've got some money coming back from the state, and that really messes things up if that doesn't come through. So it's just terrible. The impact is really bad. Now, through the summer, you can kind of be all right with it. But once the school year starts, if all of a sudden the rug is pulled out from under you, it's going to be chaotic at the local level. All of this trickles down from the state. When the state's a mess, it just makes local school districts' finances a mess, local towns a mess. The districts that tend to be more impacted, though, are the ones, obviously, who depend more on the state aid. So down our neck of the woods, if you're in, say, Weston or some place that doesn't get a ton of state funding, the impact is there, but it's nothing like it is if you're an urban or quasi-urban district where you're counting on a big slug of money from the state, and nobody can tell you what you might get. Uncertainty kills you.
So what happens, for example, we'll say Bloomfield
right.
doesn't get this state money, and I guess the funding starts arriving October 1st is a key date. What happens if that money doesn't come in? What do you do?
Every town has to handle it differently. If it's such a big change that you can't make your budget, and remember, in Connecticut, it is not legal for a school board to overspend its allocated budget. Okay? So you have to finish the year in the black. If for some reason you are counting on some state money and it doesn't come in, then either you have to make some very dramatic cutbacks to make it happen, or you have to go to the town council, board of finance, whoever your authority is, and say, look, we were expecting, $2 million in state aid for a special education or for ECS, and now we're only going to be getting $500,000. We can't make up $1.5 million. What are we going to do?
So you're saying a school system cannot operate in the red.
That's correct. It's against the law. As a matter of fact,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, board members, Board of Education members, can be personally held liable for the shortfall should that happen.
Really?
So needless to say, as a superintendent, it was not a good strategy to run a deficit since you're employed by a school board.
Right.
So, we had, this occasionally happens for unexpected reasons during the course of a year. You can get some unexpected expenses, and basically you go back to the town. Now, the town is in no better shape to bail you out, because remember, on the town side, they have the same uncertainty. They were counting on a certain amount of money, and if they're not getting it, then they don't have any sort of money to help bail you out. Now you're into, do we dip into any reserve funds that we might have as a one-time thing? And then, of course, it ends up being a big negotiations. Typically, the town will say to the school district, well, we'll help you out a little, but you really got to, crunch things. So I think a number of districts, what they did, I know down in our neck of the woods, there were a number of maintenance projects that normally would be done over the summer. Those were all put on hold because they needed to see whether the money from the state was really going to be there. Now, if those don't get done in the long run, that costs you more money.
That's right.
Because maintenance deferred just means building projects down the road that are more expensive.
Right.
But that's the kind of bad choices that are out there right now. Certainty is always better than uncertainty.
Exactly.
And right now, the uncertainty is killing everybody.
A very special guest this morning, and a dear friend, David Tidal, who did a tremendous job here in Bloomfield, and stopped by to see us this morning. Also, a superintendent down in Fairfield, and now at probably one of the best colleges in the state of Connecticut.
Sacred Heart University is, I think, a great university, and he's a professor at Sacred Heart. He's in our Touch Points Rehab interview chair. David, let's start for just a moment, because I'm sure a lot of people don't even know this. The education cost sharing, what is that?
That is the main way that the state assists cities and towns in paying for the costs of public education. It is a very complicated formula. It has been a mess for many, many years, and it was at the heart of the lawsuit that the judge over a year ago,
I saw that.
Yes, decided that it was unconstitutional because it was basically irrational. In fact, the formula to distribute money to the cities and towns got so convoluted and so out of whack that the legislature for the past, I can't remember, 5 years or more, basically has said, disregard the formula, here's what everybody's getting. And they would often just continue what people had gotten the year before. It's desperately in need of a rewrite, but there is not the will to make that happen at the present time, despite the fact that the judge basically said, you guys ought to get together and figure out a better and more efficient way to distribute resources. So some cities and towns get very small percentage of their budget from ECS. It is designed to go to the cities and towns that have the most needs, either the lowest tax base or the neediest children. So the cities, such as Hartford, New Haven, and so forth, Bridgeport, get a large chunk of their budget from the state for the ECS. The wealthy communities get relatively little. But it's a big number in the state budget. It's something that had been protected by the legislature and the governor when many states cut their assistance to cities and towns. But now it looks like that might be on the chopping block, because when you're looking for big numbers to cut, if you're running the state, you need a number to take. That number is sitting out there. So that's the basic formula. It's very complicated, and it definitely needs to be redone, but at this point, it is just sitting in limbo.
Okay, hold that thought, because we're taking calls, and if you have a question, you can give us a call at 888-574-2723. Jerry served on the Cheshire Board of Education. Jerry is on the line. Jerry, good morning. Welcome to Brad and Dan.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Good.
I'm listening with some interest to your conversation this morning. I was on the Board of Education in Cheshire for 8 years, six of which I was chair, and you were discussing the impact of cutbacks from the state prior to the break. And one of the other important things that most people don't know is the minimum funding for education requirement in the state of Connecticut. Unless, and your guest can speak to this, unless certain triggers are met, municipalities cannot fund education in a succeeding year at a rate lower than a previous year. And most people are not aware of that.
Yeah, so that's the minimum budget requirement has been around for many, many years. And it used to be very simple, just the way you described it. The town was not allowed to spend fewer dollars in the subsequent year than they were spending in the current year.
That's correct.
That was the old rule. That rule is still in effect in certain cases, but what the legislature's done in response to many towns screaming about that, I should point out, by the way, that if you spend exactly the same amount next year as you spend this year, and all your fixed costs go up by, say, 3%, salaries, benefits, and so forth,
you're already breaking the rule.
You're already 3% behind, but nonetheless.
Exactly.
So there have been some carve-outs made to that minimum budget requirement, one of which is that if you have enrollment decline, you're allowed to reduce your budget.
I don't remember the specific percentage, but there is a percentage that has to be met in a single year before you're allowed to do that.
Yeah, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but there's...
Yeah, I've been off the board for 2 years,
yeah.
I don't remember.
There's different rules. I think the priority school districts are not allowed to do that, regardless of what happens with enrollment. And
I remember.
Yeah, and certain districts, and I was in Fairfield, if you're one of the higher performing districts in the state, it doesn't apply at all. So there's been some relief on that,
But if you're sort of a middle of the road district without a big enrollment decline, then that's entirely possible that you would be required to spend at least the same amount of money in a subsequent budget year as you're spending in the first. That is a mandate. There are many, many mandates.
Oh, well, that's the other thing I just wanted to mention, and I'll let you get back to it, yep. Is the mandates or promises, however you care to word it, from the state about what they will fund and pay in their entirety and don't. So, in effect, in my humble opinion, the state knowingly breaks the laws it has created every year by not fully funding certain aspects, for example, special education, that they're supposed to and have promised to fund.
The same is true of the federal government, by the way.
That's absolutely true.
The federal government promised to in 1975, when it passed the first special education law.
Yes.
Believe it or not, I remember these things. they promised that the federal government would pay 40% of special education costs.
Right.
I don't think it's ever gone above maybe 15%.
Wow.
I don't remember the percentage, but every year, the sad fact is, and again, most people are unaware of this, and I'm afraid, Brad and Ben, you could spend a whole morning on the problems of funding of education, is that the percentage goes down as the mandates go up, the promises go up, and again, I'm sure your guests can attest to, with every new mandate or change to an existing policy, the state inserts a nice little phrase, and I am paraphrasing without the paperwork in front of me. I can't remember it offhand. But essentially, it's a caveat that allows the state to impose this new mandate or revised policy or revised mandate at no cost to the state or to the municipality. But anybody that's ever served or worked in education knows that as soon as you change a rule or a policy, there is a cost incurred.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they've been piling up. I used to put a slide in my PowerPoint presentation on the budget every year that I was in Fairfield, and I think I did it in Bloomfield as well. And I would simply put in there the new mandates that had come in the last year.
Exactly.
Right?
We did the same in Cheshire, and it stunned people.
Yes. Yeah. And by the way, none of them ever came off the slide.
I'm afraid I can take up the morning with your guests, but I will hang up and thank you for the time. And again, I appreciate what you're trying to do to educate people as to the education system and its systemic failings.
Hey, thank you very much for the call. And we're going to get back to our special guest, David Tidal, in just a moment. Now, if any of you have anything that you'd like to talk about, please call us 1-888-574-2723.
We're joining us in our Touchpoints Rehab interview chair, and he's with us until 9. Dave Tidal, former school superintendent in Bloomfield and Fairfield, assistant in Waterford, now a professor at Sacred Heart University, taking your phone calls as we talk education. Any question goes. 888-574-2723 is our telephone number. Let's go to Bob in Enfield. Welcome to Brad and Dan, Bob.
Yes, back in the 90s, I served on the Board of Education, but the 70s, 80s, and 90s were different. We've had 5, 10, 15% education increases because just about every house had a child in the school. We had 15,000 students, 45,000 population. We have the same population today, but only 5,000 students. But my question is, as far as graduation, I know there, since then there was a big push on performance of the schools, because back in the 90s, everybody said they're not getting an education. But today, I understand, and I know in Massachusetts this is true, there's a three-tier graduation diplomas. There's academic, completion, and attendance. Is that true in Connecticut or is it in Massachusetts?
Connecticut does not have that. Connecticut has one graduation, one diploma. That's not... It's not distinguished. One of the differences in the two states is that Massachusetts has what's called the MCAS. That is a state test that all graduates must pass in order to get a diploma. Connecticut does not have that. That was a big debate in the 90s. You might have been on the board when that happened, there were proposals to have an what's called an exit exam, where in order to get an official diploma, you had to pass a test. And at the time, we had the CAPT test, the Connecticut Academic Performance Test, was given in, still had been given in 10th grade. And there was a movement to convert that to the MCAS-style test. And the compromise was that local school boards, maybe you were on the board at the time, had to write graduation requirements that took CAPT into account, but CAPT could not be the sole reason why someone doesn't graduate. And individual school boards could set the standard by which kids would graduate. So that's a different animal. Connecticut did not go down the same route as Massachusetts of requiring an exit exam to get the full diploma.
But there has been conversation about that ever since, right?
Yeah. There's been conversation. And I think there was always this fear that if a high-stakes test such as that was put in place, that there might be a huge spike in the dropout rate or a reduction in the graduation rate. The Massachusetts experience has not been that. Massachusetts has done very well with that. In fact, on many measures of academic performance, Massachusetts has sort of blown by Connecticut. In fact, for a while, Connecticut had Massachusetts envy. It's one of the reasons why a couple commissioners ago, the governor hired a deputy commissioner, McQuillan, from Massachusetts, trying to catch a little Massachusetts lightning in the bottle here. That didn't work out so well. But nonetheless, that was where the states really diverged. But I don't know that that has come back.
Do you feel about an exit exam?
I actually think that if it's designed well and if it is if the students are given ample support to pass it, ample opportunity to pass it, if it's aligned to the curriculum that we want people to teach, so people aren't just teaching to this test and then teaching something else, then it has potential. But anytime you put a high-stakes test in, you run the risk of diverting all the resources in the organization to just that test. And you don't want people just teaching to the test.
I want to ask you a simple question. You probably never had it asked. I happen to think, and Bloomfield is the example that I use, that uniforms, okay, are very important in education. Some people say no. Other people say it takes away the competition of I'm wearing this, you're wearing that. What do you think about uniforms?
Well, as you know, Brad, when I was superintendent in Bloomfield, we instituted uniforms.
That's right. I was wondering if you remember that.
Yes,
you did.
I,
and that's when it all turned around.
Well, what happened was, and I think this is something that is very community specific. My belief on that is that if the community, if the parents will support it, then it can work. If the parents don't support it, and if the parents are going to be fighting the administration on it, if the parents are not going to support you at home with their kids wearing the uniforms, then all you've done is created a big mess. So before we put it in place in Bloomfield, we did a lot of outreach to the community, to the families, and a lot of the families in Bloomfield really wanted it for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. We held off a bit at the high school because that's the trickiest place to put it in place. But after a while, the high school parents came around.
Yes, they did.
And I think it was successful there. But I will tell you that while there was some conversation about it in Fairfield, there was no momentum for it. And a superintendent a school board, of course, has to pass a policy on it. Superintendents can't implement something like uniforms unilaterally. That would be something that a board of education would have to vote and take public comment on. And if the community was really against it, then they're going to let a board know about it. It won't happen. So I think it's very community specific. And in the case of Bloomfield, it made a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense in other places, but you really have to have a pulse. That's where, as a leader, as a school board member, as a superintendent, you can't just come in with the one approach to improving a school system. You really have to be in touch with the culture and the climate of the community. Otherwise, you'll be kind of one and done.
By the way, when you say uniform, are we talking about a dress code or a specific uniform?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of variations of it. In some schools, particularly some charter schools and so forth, they have a very specific uniform.
Yes, right? They do.
There's very little variation. Bloomfield wasn't quite that way. It was more than a dress code. You know, I think every school system has a dress code. If girls show up with shorts that are too short, you know, any school district is going to say those are inappropriate, you need to change. So it's more than just a dress code. This really specified that, you know, you needed to wear, say, a collared shirt. And while there might be a vendor who sells those shirts, you didn't have to buy from that vendor. So there's sort of nuances to uniforms. And I think the Bloomfield one was sort of less strict. So it was a nice mix because the community really didn't want the one size fits all, but they didn't want the anything goes either. So you really have to listen to your community, specifically your parents, because as a principal or a superintendent, if a child shows up and does not have the appropriate attire on and you call home, you want the parent to be supportive and to understand it. And there's always some friction in the beginning when you put that in. There's always people that will push it. There are kids that will push it. But if the parents are behind you, as with anything in education, if the parents are behind you, it'll work. If they're not behind you, it won't. I will also say it also had a very positive effect on teacher dress.
Yes, it right. did.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Yes, it
it's
did.
A whole other issue.
Listen, I remember the days when the male teachers, tie and jacket.
All right, so you realize that at one point we were looking to actually impose a dress code on the teachers in Bloomfield. And you know what it turns out? That's a mandatory subject of bargaining. You cannot unilaterally impose a dress code on teachers. You can suggest, you can cajole, but until it's in the contract, the labor agreement, you cannot unilaterally impose it and discipline somebody for not obeying it. The good thing was that the teachers didn't want it in the contract any more than we did. And so it worked out really well. The Teachers Association was great in Bloomfield, and there were only a few people that weren't really paying attention to it, and they got on their case. We didn't have to do it. So there was a lot of self-policing going on there. But a school board in Connecticut under the collective bargaining cannot simply say, here's the dress code for teachers. All the male teachers must wear coats and ties.
How about that?
I had to ask that.
That's, there you go.
I know Bloomfield. I see him coming home today.
Yeah.
You know, and they look tremendous. You walk into the school. It's and David started all that.
Sure. No, it definitely also brings a sense of seriousness to the organization. And I think the kids know that they're learned. It's serious. It's almost like a little bit like they're going to work.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And I think, by the way, when you dress the part, it also elevates your game to the next level, I believe, anyway.
It does not cover for poor curriculum instruction or assessment.
That's true,
you
too.
You still got to do that right.
Exactly.
You can dress people up all you want. If the curriculum instruction and assessment are subpar, they're still not going to learn.
Fair point. 888-574-2723
is
our telephone
today.
Number. All right, let's go to Scott in Massachusetts. Scott, welcome to Brad and Dan.
Good morning.
Good morning, Brad and Dan. I didn't catch the name of your guest.
Dave Title, former school superintendent in Bloomfield and Fairfield.
Yeah, yes, sir. Nice to talk to you. You know, I have wrote a little list here what I find wrong with America's education system.
Well, just give us one because we have other calls.
Yeah.
What do you find one thing wrong?
Yeah, well, they've taken prayer out of school. No saluting the flag.
Okay, let's go with those two.
Liberalism.
Thanks for the call, Scott. All right, prayer out of school, no saluting the flag. Go ahead.
All right, well, first of all, those have been litigated. And prayer is allowed in school. You can't force somebody to pray in school, but if a child wants to pray in school, they are allowed to pray. Mm-hmm. So,
is there a certain point of the day when they're allowed? Do you allot a certain point?
Well, a lot of times what people do is, way back, now, I don't know how many years ago, you used to have in the morning.
In the morning.
Right. Yeah. You used to have, please pause for a prayer.
Yep.
Okay. Now it's often just a moment of silence.
Okay.
So the children who wish to pray can pray.
But they still do that in schools?
Yes. Okay. Oftentimes. I mean, it's not a mandate.
All right.
But a lot of places do that as an offer. flags are required to be in every classroom in Connecticut.
Do they still do the Pledge of Allegiance?
They still do the Pledge of Allegiance. Every school I've been in for 37 years has done the Pledge of Allegiance in the morning. Saluting is not required.
I don't ever remember saluting the flag anyway in school.
No, we used the Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah, there have been, you know, there's just a lot of these things change because of litigation. I think we've hit a happy medium on those. What you've got in the Constitution is two parts of the First Amendment, not to get too wonky here, two parts of the First Amendment that can be in conflict with one another. One is sort of the free exercise of religion, which means if somebody wants to pray, you should let them pray as long as it's not disruptive. But the other side is that the state, through the education system, can't impose a religion on somebody. So requiring somebody to pray has been seen as sort of imposing religion on somebody. So the courts have been trying to thread the needle on that, as they have with so many different things. But again, of all the issues in public education, the biggest one is, are kids learning enough? Let's focus on that.
Exactly. Let's go to John in Bethlehem. John, welcome to Brad and
John,
Dan.
John, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Brad. Good morning, Dan.
Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Superintendent.
Good morning.
My question to you is this. I've witnessed over the years, and I'm just a regular person, it always seems that the administration is top-heavy in any school. I don't care what city, what state. And why is it when they have a cutback or a layoff, they go after a sports program, a teacher, or a guy that sweeps the floor and the lunch ladies? You never see a mid-level or top-level administrator who makes $120,000 a year get let go. Why is that?
Okay, thanks for the call, John. Great question.
Yeah, no, it's great. I think we talked this through every one of my 26 years doing budgets in Connecticut. I think, first of all, in the past 5 to 6 years, you have seen administrative cutbacks. They've happened, number one. Number two, most administrators are in schools. They're principals, they're vice principals, and their job responsibilities have just multiplied over the years. Just the impact of some of these mandates has been incredible. The work that they have to do on teacher evaluation, the work they have to do on school safety.
David, I'm going to ask you just to hold that thought. We're coming up on a hard break.
Well, here he is, our special guest. And again, Dan, very interesting.
Yes, Dave Title, school superintendent. More calls, Brad.
Here we go.
Let's go to Mark in West Hartford. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, I came in late in the conversation. I don't know if you talked about it. I believe that Chef versus O'Neill is one of the most costly bad decisions this state ever made. Our inner cities are doing worse than ever. To a point now, they're saying it's not diversity, but high-speed internet is the issues with our inner city kids are facing. You know, even though my kids are using it for games and social media, they're grasping. Would you give me your insight and your opinion, an honest opinion, I hope? Chef versus O'Neill rubs me the wrong way. We spent billions of dollars, and we found out directors are dirty, whether it was classical magnet, cherry-picking students for athleticism, or academics. It's just a big failure. So I'm hoping you can enlighten me.
Sure. I lived with Chef O'Neill for the whole time I was in Bloomfield, and the impact of it was a bit less of an issue because Bloomfield's predominantly a minority district. But the ramifications of that decision on the entire state have been enormous. I think that we made a big mistake, in my view, in betting too heavily on creating magnet schools to solve that problem. That was the main approach. Essentially, I don't know how many billions of dollars were spent in construction. Now, these schools are beautiful. These schools are great. Some kids are getting a great education there. But they're incredibly, like everything else. In some charter schools, kids are getting a great education, and in some charter schools, they're not. I think that we probably should have taken a different approach to solve that problem that could have been less costly, which is the open choice model. And that could have been put together with some more teeth, and maybe we would have had to do a little bit of construction. But we basically created a parallel school system in Connecticut with dozens of magnet schools. And to be honest with you, they really haven't solved the problem. So, you know, in some ways, I agree with you in that it is incredibly costly. The other way to solve that problem that nobody wants to talk about would have been to stop having district attendance lines be at the town level. You know, many states in this country organize their school systems on a county basis, and Connecticut has never done that. And that would be a radical shift. But my guess is that there were other ways of getting at this problem. And in fact, I'm not even sure. I mean, they've been in court so many times that the state has ever really met the intent of Schiff. And it's been how many years now? I mean, it's got to be 20.
It is 20 years.
Yeah. And so it's been very costly. But racial isolation, having all of your minority children in one school district or concentrated, I mean, that doesn't work either. So it's a very knotty problem. I just feel like the approach we took to it was way too costly. And well after we saw that it wasn't really working, we just kept going with it. We created an empire
and
for crack.
Yes, we did. Back in court again is what, yep, what it comes down to.
Right. I just think, you know, if we had bitten the bullet on redrawing attendance lines, problem probably could have been solved. It's not just a Hartford problem. That's the other issue with it,
right,
is that only addresses Hartford, but you've got the same problem in all the cities.
We're out of time. My goodness, where did the hour go?
Will you come back?
Sure, this is great.
Awesome.
This
lots
was fabulous.
Lots of issues.
Yes.
Oh, this was
we just scratched the surface.
Right. Daniel, education, important, of course. Nobody ever wants to discuss it. Well, we began today, didn't we?
You bet. We're getting educated on education.